If not now, when? And the inspiration, if I can call it that, for this talk was an article I read in a very respected Buddhist journal. In the article, the author of the article maintained that enlightenment is not possible in this modern world. Based, he says, on his own experience and the experience of his fellow practitioners that he knew that hadn't really accomplished anything through the meditation, he'd come to regard it as being an external problem, the problem of modern life, that there's so much grief, there is a lot of grief, greed, hatred and delusion in the world, too much distraction externally, that it wasn't possible for people to give the necessary attention to the path in order to become enlightened. He also suggested that perhaps it was evidence that the teaching itself was in decline, and saw it as a failure on the part of people in terms of their study and the practice of the parami, the perfections, that were to blame. He felt that nibbana was only possible in a future life, and that essentially the best we could really do is to work on the parami, compassionate action, good works essentially, and develop that, and perhaps in a future life conditions might be more beneficial or suitable. I didn't agree with him. I think he's wrong. In fact, I know he's wrong. So it was a bit sad to read, and thinking that this is in a very well-respected Buddhist journal. I wondered whether the blame did lie in external conditions, or indeed whether the decline in the teaching, or whether perhaps the non-accomplishment in terms of meditation was perhaps more rooted personally within him. It is the case that in order to succeed with meditation, with following this way, we all must confront and overcome our demons. And I think that often people will do their best to avoid doing that, even when they're meditating. It's really quite natural. It's part of the Buddhist path to unearth the ways in which we ignore life and want life to be different. But there's no way you can come to understanding without facing your demons. Our demons, what do I mean by that? I mean our greed, our hatred, rooted in a deluded way of seeing life that give rise to all the fears and the paranoias and the depressions that we experience. There are other ways of avoiding facing one's demons. Another one that I heard recently was that some people consider the Buddhist path to be selfish, self-serving. I know, it's amazing, isn't it? How can you focus on your own suffering? How can you spend your time working out how to be peaceful and calm when there is so much trouble in the world, when there is so much suffering, so much poverty, and so forth? When other people are suffering so much. Well, the answer to that is, if you had a serious illness, cancer, would you seek medical intervention? Well, of course you would. Everyone would, wouldn't they? Or is that not being a bit selfish, putting your own suffering before? Because there are plenty of other people who've got cancer and are suffering. Wouldn't it be better not to get that treatment, help other people get over their suffering, their cancer, and once everyone has been sorted, then deal with yours? It seems unlikely, doesn't it? The world of human beings is a very troubled place. The world is stalked by fear and paranoia. Even in the news at the moment, we've got the threat of war in Southeast Asia. In our own neck of the woods, we've got the greed that led to all the austerity, and now the hatred and the anger about all the austerity and the lack of services, and life's going wrong, it's all going the wrong way. The Buddha talked about people's minds being polluted. Asavas, he called them. That's the Pali term, which is often translated as cankers. They're mental pollutants. They are the greed and the hatred and the delusion and all the various defilements that come out of our greed and hatred. Another translation for the term asavas is cancers. So the troubles in the world all begin life in the mind of human beings. And therefore, how is it possible to resolve the suffering in the world without first resolving the suffering within oneself? Is it possible to get inside other people's heads and do the work for them? Of course it isn't. Everyone has to do that for themselves. Good works, being kind, being generous, being helpful to others, is a part of the Buddha's teaching. But alone it is not enough. The Buddha's teaching does work. It works very, very well. And you can only do it now. You can't do it off in the future when supporting conditions are right. We can only really do it now. But in order to succeed in the practice, you do have to face your demons. You do have to be prepared to look at those demons, because those demons stand guard at the gateway to enlightenment. And they will not let you pass, as and until you have learned all about them, understood them, and let them go. The Buddha's teaching is designed to take us through that process gently, calmly, peacefully, as best we can, to learn all about our resistances, our craving for life to be different, and gradually, very gently, learn to look those demons squarely in the face and see them for what they are: illusions. That's wisdom. You can only gain wisdom through developing the capacity to be mindful, to be present, to be equanimous, to be detached, to be willing to look at everything that occurs in your experience and truly see things for what they are. In order to be able to do that, you have to have a relatively peaceful life, which is served by living an ethical life, by keeping precepts and developing friendly, compassionate actions towards others, thus reducing self-concern. So there you have the three parts of the Buddhist training: developing an ethical outlook, developing the mind, generating his wisdom into the true nature of life. Now, these three parts, ethics, mental development and wisdom, are like a tripod. They're each like a leg on a tripod. So each one supports the other two. Something like that. So as you develop one, you develop the other two. Developing one helps to support the other two. And what I mean by that is the idea that some people believe that the idea is that you have to develop the parami, the perfections, compassionate activity first, and then you go on to meditation, and then you gain wisdom is not the case. All three have to be developed simultaneously. All three are developed simultaneously, which I'll come on to now, right now. how that works. But that's the important point to recognise, and sometimes people mistake that. They think that somehow you have to reach this point of holiness through having developed the parami to such an extent that then you can develop the other qualities, and it's not the case. You develop all three in tandem. If you can develop three things in tandem. Can you develop three things in tandem? Or only two?
It's a tricycle.
Tricycle. It is, isn't it? Where was I? Yes. I came across this in the Pali Canon, and I thought, oh, well, that just demonstrates how these three fit in really nicely. And it also demonstrates quite how powerful the Buddha's teaching is, and to think that somehow the Buddha's teaching is in decline or corrupted somehow is really, frankly, a nonsense. Queen Malika went to see the Buddha, and she asked him a really interesting question. She said, how is it that there are people who are ugly, who are ill-formed and unsightly? How is it that they're also poor and destitute, and they don't have much wealth and have very little influence in the world? And how is it that they're ugly, ill-formed and unsightly people who are actually rich with great wealth and great influence? And how is it that there are people that are beautiful, attractive, graceful, who are also rich with great wealth and great influence? And the Buddha's teaching just demonstrates quite how simple and yet how powerful his way can be. He said that if it is the case that people are irascible, if they're irritable, if they lose their temper easily, if they get angry, upset, and they display their anger and their hatred and their resentment, if they're stubborn, then, as a consequence of that, in a future life, they will be born ugly. If it is that someone is not generous, they're stingy, mean, they don't give to the Sangha, or they don't give to people that they respect, or they don't give to friends, then as a consequence, in a future life, they'll be poor. And if they're envious, if they resent the gains, honours, respect and esteem that others receive on account of the skills that they have and the qualities that they possess, and if they are envious in that way, then in the future, and I've always loved this one, due to their envy, in the future, they will be powerless. They won't have great influence. So, it seems reasonable, therefore, to conclude that if somebody, on the other hand, doesn't get angry easily, that they do restrain their anger, that they do develop qualities of friendship and amity, that in the future they will be perceived as being beautiful. If they are generous, if they are open-handed and open-hearted, if they do support, say, Sangha such as this, then as a consequence, they will be wealthy. And if it is the case that somebody wants influence, why would you want to influence? But if it is the case that you want that, then the way you get that is paradoxically through being respectful, honouring people who are worthy of respect. So the Buddha teaches loving kindness, friendliness, it teaches generosity, and it teaches respect for teachers and honouring the success of others. Now, some people go back to the selfishness thing of how the path could be perceived as being selfish. Some people think that To be generous towards the Sangha is somehow self-serving. It's somehow self-serving of the Buddha to suggest that people support the Sangha. But the Buddha himself said of himself and of his teaching and of the Sangha, and that includes people who have become stream winners or once returners or non-returners and arahants, that they are an unsurpassable field of merit for the world. Now think of that, of a field, and it's rich with nutrients, and you put a seed in. That, because it's rich in nutrients, you water that seed will grow into a plant, and that plant has more chance of being healthy because it is in such a rich, nutritious field. It all depends, I guess, what you want out of life, what you consider to be important. But in whatever area of life, if there is something that you aspire to, if there is something that you would like to know about, then by acting generously towards somebody who knows more about it than you do, especially if that person is a teacher, and you treat that teacher with respect and honour, then that teacher will look upon you kindly, and you will learn so much more because of your attitude towards that teacher. It creates this bridge of communication, openness and friendliness, and that teacher is far more likely to give you the treasures that he or she has, which is the very thing that you aspire to. Now, given the state of the world, and given that the Buddha's teaching is all about eliminating forever the roots of greed, hatred and delusion that cause all the problems in the world, what could be higher or greater or better than to give towards the Sangha that upholds that teaching, that demonstrates, in our case, that the core, the fundamentals of the Buddha's teaching are true, that his path can be navigated successfully, that there are people who have demonstrated that it has been. Sometimes I feel like we're like this little island in this sea of confusion. And there aren't too many other islands dotted around. Sometimes that's what it feels like to me. Because there are so few, even Buddhist groups, that seem to actually think that enlightenment is possible in this lifetime. Amazing. So anyway, I'm sort of going off the page a bit there. But the point being that whatever it is that you aspire to, you want to learn about, generating generosity and respect towards people with more skill than you in those certain areas will benefit you tremendously. Okay. Now, in order to learn how to be friendly, how to develop generosity, how to develop respect, also how to restrain the tendency towards anger or stinginess or envy, requires lots of mindfulness, of course. It's central to the Buddha's teaching. Developing mindfulness is the way we develop wisdom. Mindfulness is being present, being aware. As I was saying before we did the meditation, it's about paying a respectful attention to what is actually taking place in your experience. Developing wisdom, developing mindfulness is not easy, as we all know. It is tremendously beneficial for anyone who is willing to put in the time and the effort. The Buddha gave a list of four things conducive to the growth of wisdom. which I thought I'd share with you. Four things conducive to the growth of wisdom. Association with superior persons. Hearing the good Dhamma. Proper attention and practice in accordance with the Dhamma. So association with superior persons does not mean association with people who think they're superior to everyone else. Maybe it's a clunky translation. I think what it means is association with people with more skill in the area that you want to learn about. So wise people in the case of what we do here. So I'll leave it to you to work out how that is conducive to the growth of wisdom. Hearing the good Dhamma, hearing about sila, samadhi, panya, ethics, mental development and wisdom, or Four Noble Truths, or whatever it might be. Again, I'll leave it to you to work out how that is conducive to the growth of wisdom. Proper attention, I was talking about that earlier, wasn't I? But proper attention, so listening, paying proper attention when you do come, and practice in accordance with the Dhamma. So being willing to accept instruction, put that instruction into practice, and find out what happens as a consequence. So in practical terms, what do these four things mean? To my mind, it means that if somebody is serious about wanting to come to understanding, that they're willing to come on as many Wednesday nights as they possibly can, that when the choice is presented, shall I go or shall I not go, that perhaps the answer is, well, if not now, when? Retreats. Making sure that there's at least a week-long retreat every year. As a minimum, if it's serious. Because it's that important. And perhaps when the forms come around to put your name down, to allocate a space for you, and you've got the retreat slip in your hand, perhaps you might say to yourself, well, if not now, when? Interviews. Regular interviews with the teacher to discuss it, to discuss the meditation, to get stuck in. The teacher has so much treasure. There's so much available to people. Why aren't you banging on my door? You could bang on my door. You could demand it. Teach me. Tell me what I have to do. And if perhaps the thought, well, maybe I will, I'm not sure. Well, if not now, when? When's it going to happen? Ultimately, we have to overcome our demons. We have to see through them. We have to see them for what they are. And this is where I go trivial, because now I'm going to mention Tom and Jerry. It's this illustration I use. You know, in the Tom and Jerry cartoons, Tom is confronted with this shadow looming on the wall, and it looks like a terrible, horrible monster. And then a few moments later, you see the light shining on Jerry, and he's got a bit of cheese on his head or something. And Tom's attitude completely changes from sheer terror to, I'm going to get him, sort of thing. Our demons, what do I mean by demons? Our fears, our phobias, our depressions, our anger, our lusts, or what we call defilements. They're only scary when we don't look at them properly. They only loom larger than life because we're afraid. Maybe we're afraid that we'll get swept away by them. And so there's this constant battling, there's this constant fear. This constant sort of struggle to keep them at bay. And that just increases the illusion of that monster's power. These demons don't actually have any power. When you actually finally turn around and look at them directly, they wither away so quickly, so completely. I mean, they might pop up again a few moments later, but they cannot withstand the power of your mindfulness. Thoughts are nebulous things. As you meditate more and more, you begin to see how ephemeral, how fleeting these thoughts are. And as you look at transience more and more, you see that the things that these thoughts pertain to don't have the solidity and reality that you thought they did. And then you look at the world, and you look at how crazy the world is and how crazy people behave, and yet you see that actually they're chasing shadows. They're fighting shadows. They're fighting things that have appearance but no real depth, no real reality to them. And you wonder why. But then you realise, God, they're deluded. It's because their ignorance is so strong. It's ignorance and resistance that create all the problems in the world. So yes. So each time we meditate, we have to be willing to let the demons in. Because they're only demons because you've made them into demons. They're only a trouble because you haven't looked at them properly. So the task of meditation really is to sit and allow whatever wants to come into the mind to come in and to observe its true nature. Now, it might be in the interim that that means a lot of sort of tussle and hard work and difficulties in learning how to restrain the temptation to try and beat them away and get them away. And there is a lot of real experience in learning about how the more you resist, the stronger those things get. But isn't that worth it? If, as a consequence of that challenging work, you come to completely understand and comprehend things like daydream, fantasy, worry, anxiety, fear, loneliness, sense of shame. Oh, the list is endless, isn't it? Fortunately, we don't have to confront all of them. We have our own particular favourites. And when it comes down to it, you've only got three or four favourites at the most that you like to do, that you like to keep going. The world is ruled by illusion. But you don't have to be ruled by illusion. To sum up, there are many ways to avoid facing your demons. And in a sense, everyone has to try as many of those as they care to, including perhaps, as I started suggesting, that it's just not possible to become enlightened in this lifetime. You think what a labour-saving device that little view is. Or indeed that it's somehow selfish to learn how to let go of your selfishness. But the reality is that as and until somebody does face their demons, the demons will be in, if not in full control, they will be regularly appearing for that person. They'll be like a shadow following that person down through lifetime after lifetime after lifetime. So there'll be no peace, no true peace, no true freedom until those demons have been overcome. So, if not now, when? And I think it's sometimes going back to the idea of the Buddha, this idea of enlightenment as being an unsurpassable field of merit. I think it is possible. Because it's such a subtle thing to fail to recognise the true power of the enlightened mind. It's got a power all of its own. It's got an influence all of its own, which is unlike anything else. But it's subtle because it's not something the enlightened mind does. It's what it's not doing. And it's not doing greed, hatred, and ignorance. The enlightened mind is in perfect harmony with its surroundings at any given time. It's not creating any waves of resentment or fear or terror or paranoia. Rather, it is aware of all those things, and the enlightened mind just simply accepts whatever is there and doesn't fight with it at all. So it's perfectly at peace, even amidst the craziness of life. And it's very easy, I think, for people to not notice, to overlook that, because it is such a subtle thing.